Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up, it's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's July 13th, 2012. You're listening to the best PokerCast in the world. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And, oh my gosh. I am Scott with a frog in his mouth. See, I can't even get the cliches right anymore.
Yeah, I know.
Scott with a frog in his throat long.
Well, see, what's good about it is that they're never cliche when you use them because you never get them right. So they can't be cliche, so.
You know, because people are going to start saying, whoa, boy, that guy, he had a frog in his mouth. So, yeah, hey. I'm just coming up with these catchphrases for people to use.
Oh, man. I don't know about you, but I have been following the World Series basically because it's my job.
Don't tell me. I'm going to wait. I'm going to watch it in November.
Oh, you're going to wait to find... Actually, you're going to watch it in October, so...
Ah!
You know, in the beginning of the series, they were like, oh, the numbers are down, the dealers are unhappy, blah, blah, blah. So we got the number report this week. You know, as soon as it got to the main event, they always send out that stuff. And it's very interesting.
I found it, to borrow your word, very interesting.
Yeah, it's certainly not the... You know, and the other thing, too, is when we went to Vegas, and I think we talked about this on the show, it perpetrated that feeling a little because of how organized they were.
Right.
We talked about there's nobody in the hallways because everybody's in a room playing where they're supposed to be, and it's so well, you know, oil machine kind of thing that you'd think, oh, my God, there really isn't a lot of people. But you know what? There were a lot of people at this event again. total entries, 74,766. Second most all time.
Yep.
So much for the numbers being poor and on a decline.
And total prize pool was $222 million in change. Most all time. Now, what I want to say about these first two, and I'm not trying to rain on the recovery parade here because it really was a very good recovery and the numbers are impressive, but they had more events this year, didn't they?
61, yeah. They had, I think it was it 58 last year? So maybe three
yeah,
more events.
So at least three or four or more events this year. So it's one of those that I like to call in the back in the journalism business, so, you know, kind of a, not a BS number, but a number with a caution sign on it.
Yeah.
You know, if you, let's say you're running a fast food restaurant and you have four locations one year and next year you have 12 locations and you're like, hey, we're doing gangbusters business. Well, yeah, obviously you are because you got three times as many stores. You know, you got to find another way to quantify it a little bit. So so I didn't go back and actually do that and, you know, redivide it in to see, you know, whether the actual per event was up more or not. But, you know, like I said, I don't want to rain the parade. That's good. I mean,
sure.
When we were out there, I would have been shocked if you would have told me that these numbers would have came in like this.
Sure, and let's say the three new events they added, you can't automatically assume it's the 1K with 9,000 extra people for three events.
True.
It makes it 65,000. It could have been the three extra events were the ones that had 500 people in them. I mean, who knows? So, yeah, I totally agree that there were more entries. And also, too, I think, was this the first year with re-entry? And do they count those re-entries as entries?
Yeah,
So that helps a little bit, too. But you can't ignore $222 million. I mean, that's, you know, no matter how much money is added to those prize pools, that's a crazy amount of money. And clearly, poker's not dying. No matter how many events you added, this is $222 million was up for grabs. And that's just the prize pool, not to mention the rake. So
yeah,
that's,
I mean,
a lot
think about
of money.
That's as much money that went through that one casino, that one part of that casino, in the span of, you know, what, 2 months?
Yeah.
Less than that?
Less than 2 months, yeah.
And I haven't checked my census lately. Lee Childs is going to, you know, scold me for this since his wife works for him. But I think there's, what, something like 300 or 400 million Americans, something like that, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I don't guess.
Well, it's almost like every American donated 50 cents. You know, you think about those, yeah. You know, Alyssa Milano commercials now. You know, you could feed the, you know, a village in Sahara something or other for 50 cents a day. And this, you know, if every American gave 50 cents, that would be the prize pool. To me, that's mind-boggling.
Yeah, it is mind-boggling. That's pretty crazy.
You know, people always ask you when you start a business, I'm like, you know what? I always thought this before, obviously not with the business that we started, but, you know, if I could get every American to give me $1 for whatever I'm doing, that would be awesome, wouldn't it?
It would be.
And here they gave him 50 cents or something like that. I'm sure somebody will call right in and say, hey, you know, there's 7 billion people here, Sky. Yeah, you're clueless. But yeah.
And we are not running a correction next show. I don't care. I don't care if that you were so. I don't care if there's 50 people in the United States and you got it wrong. I'm not mentioning this again. It was an amazing stat, and you came up with a cool way to show it. So that's all we're doing with it. Don't expect us to run any kind of clarification because we're not doing it. So,
but you know, from a public policy standpoint, I mean, does this not show how popular poker is?
I know it's remarkable. And then you know, when you get to the main event here, where you know 65-98, and then in parentheses we have down 200 from last year. That's nothing, and this is still without online poker being completely legal, or however you want to phrase it, looked upon as legal, and all the big kahunas out of the market. We're only down 200 people in the main event. Imagine what it's going to be like when online poker filing gets regulated. There are going to be 12,000 people in this damn thing.
Yep. Yeah.
So, yeah, this absolutely is a testament to how popular this game still is, how strong it is, and how strong the poker economy is, and that the money is still being found, produced, generated, whatever you want to call it, to get into this damn tournament series. And this is just the World Series. Don't forget that how many of those freaking tournaments are popping up all over Vegas. Every time we're out there, they're all, numbers are down, the numbers are down. Yeah, but you're creating more and more series every year, and they're still breaking records or essentially meeting expectations. It's crazy. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, you know, another way of looking at it from a government standpoint, I mean, we'll use here in Florida. Now, this isn't a net number. This is the prize pool. So, I mean, you have to take the rake out of that. But here in Florida, I mean, you take 10% off, go straight to the state. So, you know, let's assume there's no rake here just for laughter. But right. Still, that's $20 million in revenue for the state of Florida. The state of Florida would have had this event here.
Yeah.
And you know, other states have probably higher tax rates on that as well, too. And, you know, trust me, our listeners in Tennessee, they'd be like, I'm pretty sure they would be fine with a high tax rate just to be able to play poker like that. Yeah. And, you know, $20 million over 6-7 weeks.
Man.
Pretty good day at the office for the government for not doing anything but just letting us play the game.
Yeah, absolutely crazy.
All right, well, you mentioned the main event. It was essentially flat, which I think is an achievement in itself. And then day 1C, 3,418 players showed up. Single-day record for the main event. And again, this is one of those numbers that I say it's a little off a little bit because they had, you know, 4 day 1As for the last several years, right?
Right.
So now they have 3, and of course everybody waits the last minute. Some legitimately, some, you know, because they're trying to satellite in or, you know, win the game and going right up to the deadline. Other people just, you know, are lazy. But I don't think it's shocking that the last day is the big event. In fact, actually, I think they planned this pretty well, considering that, to take some time out of the schedule for the main event. But,
right.
But they probably, it's also a marketing thing. Say, hey, we had 3,400 people come in to play the main event in one day.
That's right around the number that played that event I played in. Which obviously was just a regular undercard event, but that's right around what I was up against. It was like 3,300 or 3,400 or something. So that's just insane when you think about how many people are in one place doing one thing with one common goal on that one afternoon. It's mind-boggling.
Well, here's one that I found most interesting of all the stuff. The last 12 years, there has been a player who has won at least 2 bracelets in the World Series. This year, no repeat winners. Streak is snapped. That's one of them that I thought would never...
Well, it's not snapped yet. right?
Well, that is true.
The main
that
event.
That is true.
Somebody can win the main event who won a bracelet this year. And certainly Vanessa Stelps is doing very well right now at the time of this taping. She could easily win the main event. And that would stop a huge streak of a woman not winning the main event. But, yeah, I mean, in all likelihood, it's probably snapped. You're right. It's crazy.
Yeah. And then this one, I always think it's fun that they find, some interesting people to mention in there. Of course, they had the youngest and the oldest in the World Series main event, but that's not really all that interesting anymore, I don't think. But most consecutive annual World Series of Poker's played, Howard Tahoe Andrew of Walnut Creek, California, has now played in the World Series of Poker for 39 consecutive years.
Man, that's crazy. And I know...
That's 10 years longer than I've been on this earth.
Yeah, because it's only been around 43 years, so he's only missed four. He only missed the first four or whatever. Wow. 39 years. Yeah. Yeah, I was two when he started playing. And, of course, I think we had the biggest effect on this next stat.
Yes, exactly.
Most cashers at the World Series without a bracelet win. Tony Cousineau, our good friend from Daytona Beach, our player of the year a few years back. He extended his record with the most cashes to 53 without a win. He cashed four times this year. And I feel absolutely terrible because we went over there and talked to him. And I would bet that the little conversation we had with him was the reason he did not win that event. So I feel bad. I'm sorry, Tony. Hopefully next year will be your year.
Well, you know, we kept the streak alive for him. So, you know.
That's true, too. He's got some
He's going to build it
notoriety.
Up to Joe DiMaggio levels and then win so he can, you know, no one can ever challenge him in it. So
you're saying he's not going to.
Did him a favor.
Not going to win a bracelet until 2016 is what you're telling
Probably.
Me.
Probably. Okay. Right. Exactly. Right. If I was him, that's what I would do, you know. all right, so this next item we want to talk about, getting away from the World Series, but I've had this on the notes for a couple weeks and been looking forward to chatting with you about it. Mike Sexton, who I think is probably one of the most respected poker players around, correct me if I'm wrong.
Sure.
Doesn't do any crazy stuff, and obviously a good ambassador for the game, both on Capitol Hill and just the face of the World Poker Tour. He wrote a blog on his partypoker.com blog that essentially said poker pros are blowing it, Chris. He lamented that they don't show up for media interviews, they dress shabbily when they're on TV, they're just not getting a very good representation of themselves to the general public, and he says until they clean up their act, they're never going to be able to attract some of this outside sponsorship money that everybody seemingly wants to have. Now, we think we mentioned this a little bit on the show before, talking about it, but now we got one of the good guys saying, clean it up. I mean, no one's going to listen to Scott and Chris. But will they listen to Mike Sexton? That's my first question to you.
Well, here's from our standpoint, and I think we really recognized that this time out there when we went to the World Series. You know, our magazine really, and even our show, really likes to cater to people like us. People who want to sit down and be the weekend grinder and play in a tournament occasionally, and if we do win one that's of some decent recognition, then we get the recognition as well for it. So for me now, we've been out of the, hey, let's go track down that exciting pro, let's go talk to this A-list pro. We've been out of that game for a while now, and it's hard for me to really pontificate on what I think, poker players, pros who are popular or not, should do when they're faced with that. But I can totally agree with him when it comes to like pros blowing you off and stuff like that. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've had these, tried to line up these interviews with these guys for when they were going to be on our cover of our magazine, and it's just like pulling teeth. So, do I think they'll listen to Mike Sexton? Probably not. And the reason why is because I really think that a lot of these young pros, and a lot of them are clicky and they're brash and they do what they want to do. Some of it gets back to the fact that I often ask this question of the people who are thrust into the limelight because they won. You know, when before the boom, these people were just playing poker to make a living. They didn't play poker to be a celebrity. Now it's understood that if you play poker and do well, you're going to be a celebrity. So they should have known that going in. And learned it. So if they haven't learned it now, I don't think they're going to, because Mike Sexton tells them they're missing the ball. You know, it's hard for him, for us to really see the impact or the effect of it, because when you look at the numbers of the World Series, they're still getting $222 million to vie for without Mike Sexton's, you know, sage-like advice of how to attract more money to the game. But I not that I disagree with him, and for us to for people to understand what we're talking about here, you have to really read his blog, and I'll put the link up in the recap. But I don't know if they'll listen to him. I really don't. I just don't know if... And the other thing, too, is he's so old school that a lot of these young guys, you know, they've seen him on TV and stuff, but maybe they don't respect his poker playing. They respect his ambassadorship, and I don't know if that's enough. I really don't know.
Even if they respect that. I mean, yeah. I mean, there's probably some that don't even respect that. Yeah. So. One little nit I'll pick with you on that. The prize pool is different from the sponsorship, and that's what he's talking
about. Oh, no, I know. But, I mean, he just makes it sound like the game could die if they don't. I thought that was sort of the effect I got.
Yeah, that's probably a little bit more dramatic. You're right. But I think his overall point was, hey, we might be able to get money from a Ford Motor Company or an Axe body spray or something like that. Well, maybe Axe is probably a bad example because you can be an idiot.
And nice. Axe, well, they'll never sponsor our magazine.
Spray their stuff on you. But you know what I mean. It's a different kind of class. It's not a traditional mainstream advertiser. But, you know, it's like a Ford Motor Company. What he's trying to say is, I think the game has gotten big enough now. We've got enough reach. We've got enough mainstream appeal that we can bring these folks in. But when you're going to a pitch meeting with guys that show up to the pitch meeting in press suits and ties, and you're bringing in the star of their commercial wearing flip-flops and shorts, and by the way, a big satellite dish watch that probably cost $4 million, they're probably looking across the table like, you know what, this is not a good representation of our brand. This isn't what we want to do, regardless of the fact that you're going to get us, you know, exposure to a new audience that we may want.
You know, and I agree. And the other thing, too, is that this is kind of one of those catch-22 chicken and egg things, because let's take another sport for an example, where like tennis, where they have corporate sponsorship and they can minimize the field of how many people are going to play for these titles and prize pools. And then, like, if you take Wimbledon, for example, you have to wear all white when you play Wimbledon.
Exactly.
You can't wear something else. And are people going to say, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to play Wimbledon? No, if you can play Wimbledon, you're going to play Wimbledon because it's so prestigious. And I think we've gotten to that point now where a lot of these poker events are considered prestigious, so people aren't going to not play in them because of, say, a dress code, which he actually talks about in his blog. But at the same time, you have to convince these people to clean up their act so that sponsorships will see it and then say, okay, now we can be associated with those types of people because they've cleaned up their act. Now we can put sponsorship money into this, and now we can demand that these people dress. You know, so it's kind of like, which comes first, six of one, half dozen of the other? I don't know. It's an interesting conundrum that you're faced with here. You really got to get them, like he said, to wake up and smell the coffee and put forth the effort to make themselves presentable and open. And then when that happens, then the money might come in, and then you can worry about, hey, you know what? People may not show up because they don't want to dress this way, but there's so much dead money now in this because it's a sponsored thing, you know, free money or overlay, however you want to term it, that they're going to want to put on that collared shirt and pants and shoes, you know, instead of, you know, you looked at the $1 million entry, the winner, Antonio Spandiari, and he's playing without shoes on.
Yeah.
He's got his sandals that's, you know, that are probably been through more showers than I can imagine, strewn across the floor, and he's got bare feet on the tile playing for $18 million. And it was one of the most exciting events ever, and it was on national TV, and will go down in history as the most, you know, incredible event. And he's sitting there in shorts and bare feet. And it's weird. And not to say you shouldn't be comfortable at the table or whatever, but really, you know, we're doing this for a cause, and we're doing this for recognition, and that's the other thing too, is I thought about writing something for the magazine this issue about how this event that we're the One Drop was so important, and it came at such a time when we needed it to show that there's a bunch of millionaires throwing in a bunch of money in the middle to make a bunch of money, but it also raised almost $6 million for an incredibly important cause, and that's what we can be too. We're also philanthropists. We're also people who want to help. and can help when they have the time to do. There's a lot of great things being done by poker players with their money and their time, and that's the kind of stuff that should be, you know, spotlighted. And I just I think he's absolutely right, Mike Sexton, in what he's saying, and I agree with it. And I just don't know if it's enough coming just from him.
Right, absolutely. Well, you know, I'll close it by just saying, you know, I always believe in my personal life, respect begets respect, you know. And I think really the problem here is you've got these people, so many of these people that have never, they don't have the life experience to understand that.
Yeah.
You know, they've made a lot of money in this game very quickly at a very young age. And they're friends with a lot of people that have made a lot of money really quickly at a very young age in this. And for them, they're just having fun and not seeing that bigger picture. And, you know, that's at the end of the day, you know, they start conducting themselves in a more professional manner, they're going to be treated more professionally by people other than their clique, as you mentioned. And, you know, I don't know how you legislate that. I think that's at least what you're saying. Do we need a dress code? I don't know about that. There needs to be enough people out there telling these folks, you know, hey, try to look presentable, try to act presentable, and guess what? You're going to be rewarded for it.
And just one last thing. The weird thing here, and I think we'll all agree, is that that's what was supposedly, at least ostensibly, put to us with the Epic Poker League. That's what they were trying to achieve, we think, at least, is that having this sort of league that it's all these respectable people who are the top of the game, who will conform to these rules of whatever the rules were to get sponsorship, and they kind of were going on that path, except they had a poor business model, and it didn't work out. But it's weird that the one thing that people are frowning upon now within the industry, other than, you know, Ray Pitar and all that stuff, but yeah. Really, that one thing was really kind of trying to do what Sexton was hoping would be done here, and to get respectable businesses to come on board and sponsor and see us as a legitimate industry. So it's kind of weird that happened, but you know. But he's right, though. I think it'd be wise of people to get on, enough people get on board to sort of perpetrate this sort of, you know, group consciousness of, hey, we need to clean up our act a little more to get more respect and more money that's given to us. But
very true.
All right, our hotline is 813-448-1120. Call it. We use it. We'll give you something cool if we haven't used it before. This comes from Mr. No Swag.
I wanted to ask you a quick question on your next year's cruise schedule. Are you by any chance going to come back to New Orleans, or maybe even go a little farther and come out of Galveston?
Yeah, first of all, I love the fact that Mr. No Swag has not changed his name yet, because we're not legally bound to give him any swag. Even after a year, when his name is No Swag, he can't accept it, you know. The short answer, no, we're probably not looking at going out of New Orleans, and certainly not out of Galveston. And not to dig too deep into our business model here, but, you know, what kind of sets us apart is that we like poker rooms to offer satellites or giveaways to their players. That's an important part of our business model. And when we did the New Orleans cruise, it was a successful cruise, but we didn't get a lot of that that love from poker rooms in Louisiana, Mississippi, elsewhere. And it makes it a tough sell for us, you know, when we have other areas that we think that we will get that kind of support from. So and then Galveston, just to be honest, it's actually a little bit more expensive than New Orleans to sail out of, and then you're farther away from poker rooms at that point, plus I gotta drive the truck an extra 4 or 5 hours each way. So that's probably never going to be a consideration for us going forward. But we are looking at a completely different port next year, and hopefully in the next couple of weeks we'll be able to let people know where that is. But and also looking to try to do even 4 cruises next year rather than our normal 3. So we're trying to expand it. We wish we could do it in lots of different places, but there's lots of reasons for doing it a little closer to home. So, but hopefully Mr. Noteswag will choose to come on a cruise somewhere that we are going out of. They do have airplanes now. And if he actually comes on a cruise, I will, even though his name is Mr. Noteswag, I will give him some swag.
Well, anyway, since we're talking about cruises, we might as well just say that, you know, don't forget we have, you know, two more this year. Go to antiupmagazine.com/cruise. August 27th out of Port Canaveral. We have giveaways at Palm Beach Kennel Club, Seminole Hard Rock Hollywood, Tampa Bay Downs, Ebro Greyhound Park, and, of course, Blue Shark Optics is doing something cool with a video, so check that out as well. And then November 10th out of Baltimore, Dover Downs is giving away some cruise packages for us as well. So just don't forget that there are other ways that you can get on board, not just buying in directly. So, okay, but don't forget, you call our number, 813-448-1120, and we'll maybe give you something kind of cool. So, we got a mailbag this week, too. You going to read it or you want me to read it?
You can read it. You can read it. Because I'm gonna guess that I'm going to have to answer this one.
Okay. Joe Coppolino says, how do you avoid the trappings of casino life? He thinks of poker as a game of skill that is played in houses of luck, and I think most poker players are honorable and generous, but surrounded by degenerates and thieves. A casino is a treacherous place to navigate, and it is very easy to lose yourself in that lifestyle, as I did a few years back. I have since avoided all games other than poker, and I have built a nice bankroll and have been able to provide a little extra for my family, playing a few times a week the past few years. What I would like to hear you guys talk about is how it is important to your poker bankroll to stay away from these games, how these games can even affect the way you play poker, how they can cause you to lose focus, also how you guys avoid the trappings of casino life with all the business you do with casinos. It's pretty funny because I think of without those other games, your bankroll would be non-existent.
No, that's a very good point. You know, it's that those are the kind of things that pay the bills, keep the casino open, and separate some of the less successful people from their money to make sure you can play poker. But yeah, that's a very good point. So see, hey, maybe I should have read it, and then you would answer. The last question I thought is something that actually that the wife and I have been discussing lately, because you know she's been on a couple business trips with me lately, and her favorite thing is to watch me walk into a casino and see whether it'll take 10 steps or 12 steps for me to lose my cool and blow my steam trying to get around these meandering slot zombies, I call them.
Yeah.
Floating from slot machine to next, usually with a cigarette in their hand ready to ash me. And they don't know where they're going, and I, you know, I turn to the right, and they turn to the right, and we turn to the left. I'm like, oh, just get out of my way! And I said that in the last, I forget what casino we were in, and Laura stopped, and she's like, need I remind you that this is the life you chose? This is the business that you wanted to get into, and now you're upset about it? I'm like, no! You know, poker players have their own problems, but they're not slot zombies. They put the poker room right by the door, then I wouldn't mind it. But my first answer to Joe is it's easy for me to avoid the trappings of this casino life because it gets tiring after a while.
Yeah,
I think, you know, I get tired of the dinging of the slot machines. I get tired of the cigarette smoke and my clothes reeking. You know, when I go back to the hotel room, as much as I love buffets, I get tired of going up there and getting my, you know, fried rice on the first meal, and then the prime rib and the mashed potatoes on the second plate. And, you know, it's a tiring life. And I think if you ask poker players that, they say the same thing about poker in general. But, so, you know, I don't spend as much time in the actual casino life when I travel anymore. I mean, I'll be in the poker room and I'll be in my hotel room. Or lately, you know, I try to get out and go out and enjoy something else, like a baseball game or something. So I don't know if that answers his question, but I think eventually you get tired of it.
Well, the other thing, too, with us is it's a business. So most people get trapped because they're going there already for entertainment. And then if they go there and then they're trying to chase their money somehow, they might see, hey, you know what, if I take this money here instead of trying to win a poker tournament, I can put it on red or black and double it in a second. They might see that trap and fall into it and then get into trouble with their money or their rent money or whatever it is. And for us, it's, hey, where are we going today? Why are we going there? Let's go. Let's conduct our business, and then let's go to the next business thing or whatever it is. So by the time we're actually looking to be entertained by these casinos, it's the end of the day. We're tired, and we just need to play some poker to relax, or to play some poker because we're there and we need to experience that poker room because we're going to write about it or know about it in the show or whatever it is. So for us, it's easier to avoid the other games or trappings because of the business itself. As for people who are going to casinos just for entertainment, you know, again, I would never poo-poo the casino industry. That's what's paying our bills. And so, you know, if people want, if they go there with that in mind that it's entertainment, then it's not really a trap. You just go what you can afford to lose, and what you can't afford to lose, you keep home. And then on top of it, you know, I also look at poker, as most people do, as a skill thing. So I know that if I'm better than the people at the table, I'm going to win. If I'm not, I also know that I should recognize that and will leave. So if I'm looking at it that way, then I know going through the casino, all those other games I can't beat because essentially, except for maybe blackjack, but because there's a house edge, and we all know there's a house edge, and you're not meant to win. You're meant to be entertained. So for me, when I look at it that way, when I'm going through these casinos, I see a slot machine that's blinking and attractive lights and, you know, makes me drool and crawl over to it. I know that if I put my money in there, it's only if very randomness will I maybe win a few bucks. So I just, that's how I avoid it. I think of what I'm doing as a skill and not as entertainment, and just go and do what I have to do and then get out.
Yeah, I mean, it speaks to poker as much as it does the other ones, but the other games I think is more important is you're right, it's entertainment. That's how we sell it to the public. That's how we should always sell it to the public. And, you know, some people find fun in winning money, absolutely. But, you know, if you're doing these other things to win money and you're not enjoying it, that's when you've crossed the line.
Yeah.
You know, I'll go put $10 down on the devil race and, you know, even though the pitching match doesn't work out because I'm a fan, right?
Right.
That's fun. If I win the $17.50, great. If I didn't, you know, it was fun watching the game knowing I had money on it. That's a different story than probably what, you know, Chris Moneymaker told us about when he was on the show, you know, where he was just trying to get unstuck and kept betting more and more. That's a problem. And I guess the last thing I told Joe is, you know, some of this has to be done on a personal level. I mean, this works for me, may not work for everybody else, but when I get up in the morning, I look in the mirror and I decide whether I like the person looking back at me. And some days I will think, you know, yesterday was not a good day for Scott Long. And I'll think about what I did, why I didn't like it, and then I pledge not to make those same mistakes. So there are days that I went and lost $300-$400 at the craps table, looked in the mirror the next morning, and I'm like, that's not who I want to be. And then I quit doing it. Easier said than done, obviously. But I do think there's a lot of personal responsibility and reflection each day that kind of helps you get away from some of these. All right, Joe, hey, we appreciate you sending it in. Everybody else, email your mailbag to podcast@annieupmagazine.com. If we use it on the show, we're going to give you something great. We're going to give Joe today a download of the Chinese 13-card poker app from Apple products, from Smapsoft. You don't have to be a winner to enjoy this great app. You can download it yourself by visiting the iTunes store.
All right, call the floor this week. Comes from Todd Mashad, and he says that he was playing in a WPT $300 preliminary event with 1,000 players. It was his first big tournament. 4 players see a flop. Seat 2, seat 4, seat 7, and myself on the button. And then he's in seat 9. Flop comes, and seat 2 makes a big bet. Seat 4 calls, and seat 7 calls. I shove my fairly short stack. Seat 2 goes into the tank and finally folds, and seat 4 folds. I pull back my all-in bet, and the dealer pushes me the pot. After I get the pot, I give her my cards, which she puts in the muck. Seat 7 then says, "What about me?" He still has his cards and his chips from the previous call in front of him. The floor is called. I stand by the fact that once the pot is pushed to me, I can release my cards. Seat 7 is not fighting for the pot. He feels bad for missing the action. He was not trying to make a move. What do you think should happen? The floor ruled that the pot belonged to seat 7, since he was the only one still holding live cards. I was livid, having done nothing wrong. The floor person leaves the table, and seat 7 looks at me and says, "You can keep the pot if I can keep my calling bet," which was still in front of him. I agree to the deal, and the dealer says nothing. She was an obviously new trained dealer who had likely dealt only a few times. I think she felt bad for screwing up and didn't want any more attention. The players at table talked about it for a while, but no one ever called the floor back to enforce the ruling. I know a player deal should never happen over a floor rule, but I was so upset about losing money after having done nothing wrong. This was my first big tournament, and I had only been playing for a few months and had maybe 50% of my current knowledge of the rules.
This is what Jody has to say. He says, the dealer should have known who had cards, but mistakes do happen. When this is the case, the responsibility lies with players to be paying attention. I find it hard to understand how a player in seat 9 wouldn't know the player in seat 7 has cards. It would be more understandable to me if the player was on the other side of the table in the 1 or 2 seat. The ruling was technically correct, but a situation like this is case by case. When a tournament director encounters these types of situations, they have to make a determination on whether they go with the letter of the law, which states you are personally responsible for protecting your hand and your right to the pot, or go with TDA rule number 1, which allows us to do what we feel is best for the game. What really bothers me about your situation is the fact that seat 7 watched the pot get pushed, let you muck your hand, and then decided to speak up. Based on that alone, I would have declared his hand dead and allowed you to keep the pot. It's easy to second guess others from the armchair without all the pertinent facts. Since I didn't see this firsthand, I can't disagree with the decision that was made. I'm sure the TD was doing what he thought was right.
God, you know, the thing about it is, let's say you do use rule number 1 and say, okay, then Todd should get the pot, but then the person in seat 7 says, well, wait a minute, why does he get the pot? Because I was, say, looking at my cards when he was mucking, not realizing he was mucking, or I took a bite of my sandwich, or I didn't realize it wasn't, or I was looking at a TV, or... So, I mean, you could easily interpret both, because what he said in there was that we're all responsible for our own hands.
Right.
But, you know, the guy didn't do anything wrong, because he, just because he didn't speak up doesn't mean he didn't do anything wrong either, if he was distracted or something. You know, we don't know the thing behind it, so, wow, this really is kind of weird.
Yeah, you know, this is one of those, I hate the pile on dealers, because I think dealers work very hard, and people don't understand how difficult of a job dealing is. In fact, I actually had a great conversation with Ryan Gibbs out in Colorado. I think he sent in a letter that we talked about where he's starting to deal in bar leagues now. And when he's dealing now, he's just really realizing how difficult the job is. But, you know, this is one of those things where it can't be solved by the dealer, but it could have been prevented by the dealer. You know, the dealer should know who has cards. You know, when they collect it, 4 people to the pot. I love when dealers say that.
Yeah.
Because 1, it reminds me who's in the pot, and 2, it shows me that they're paying attention.
Yep.
And they're counting, and they know. And, you know, it seems a little trivial, but there are dealers that actually will take their finger and move it from person to person when the action's on them. And if you do that, you're never going to miss somebody, because you're going to go to the, and you're going to be in C7, and the dealer's going to go, hey, whoa, whoa, hey, there's somebody still with cards here, before you muck your hand. Now, and this is the problem I think a lot of people have, is, and I'm sure the dealer would probably agree with me here, that he or she made a mistake here, right?
Yeah.
But the recourse is on the player, not on the dealer. You know, they can't... And, you know, Todd mucked his hands. Obviously, he didn't see the other person, and the dealer pushed the pot. And I went back and forth with Todd a little bit. It's like, you know, hey, when they push to me the pot and take my cards, I have to trust that they know what they're doing at that point, right?
Yeah,
you can't. That's just the letter of the rule. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, we don't want to turn this into something where before you give the cards up, you're asking everybody to show their hands at the table so you could take inventory and make sure no one's hiding cards. You know, there's a ridiculous factor that gets involved here. You know, it's in this big vat of unfortunate situations that don't have good solutions, I don't think.
One of the things that we have to remember when we're sitting at a poker table is that although the house is allowing you to have this game there and the house can stop the game if they have to because it's their property, ultimately it's still your game. You're just renting that dealer essentially or whatever. So you are responsible for your game with their rules. It's kind of weird. It's a weird thing because they set the rules, but it's your game because you're responsible for your own hand and what's going on in your game, and then you have people that you're looking to make the ruling in their house rules, but essentially it's still you're playing your game and you have to watch out for everything. So it is hard to imagine that Todd didn't see those cards. It's kind of weird, but he didn't. I mean, clearly he didn't. Maybe they were Maybe had the other guy had his hand on the cards. Who knows? Protecting
them. Maybe somebody had a Swiss Army knife and stuff on their cards.
That's just way too inside of a joke, buddy. kicking it old school from, 2008 or whatever, 7. So, but yeah, maybe somebody had a bunch of crap, like their card protector and their lucky cards or their pictures of their kids, and you didn't see the cards. So really, it is a difficult thing. But you went into that hand four-handed, and you watched two people fold, so... You gotta pay attention too when you're at the table.
All right. The other thing I hear, and I'm surprised that Jody didn't bring it up, but the side deal that they made at the end.
Yeah.
And Todd admits, hey, this shouldn't be happening, but I was upset, and he offered it to me, and no one said anything. That can happen. And I guarantee you, that will not happen at the table I'm sitting at. I am quiet as a church mouse, but if somebody makes a side deal at the table, I am speaking up, and I'm gonna say, hey. That was a truly brutal thing that just happened there. To both of you, I feel bad about it, but the floor ruled you're not going to make your own side deal, and I'm going to have the floor come over here and tell you that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a tournament.
Yeah.
You know, that affects everybody, not just you at the table or the other people at the table, but everybody else playing in the tournament, and you have a duty to protect the rights of all those other people at those other tables that don't know what's going on here.
Absolutely.
And to speak up and say, no, I'm sorry, you got a raw deal, pay attention next time.
That is pretty weird that they...
Isn't it?
They made their own deal.
We're not talking about the $30 tournament at your local four-table room that they do just to get people in the morning. It's a $300 event during a World Poker Tour event.
Yeah.
I mean... Sometimes, we know that there's so many tournaments these days that the dealer pool is spread pretty thin. So, I don't want to go back to picking on the dealers again here. But, the players, the quality of the players, even at a $300 event, you would think would be enough that there'd be somebody at the table that would say, whoa, dudes, not happening on my watch.
Yeah.
I mean, that's shocking, isn't
bizarre.
It?
Absolutely bizarre.
Unless people are just so shell-shocked by this whole thing that already happened, which I can see. I mean, again, it's an unfortunate situation that they're just like, all right, man, I'm going to let them have it. But, the rules are in place to protect people that can't speak for themselves, and that's what you need to bring up. So,
man.
All right, Todd, well, we gave you some swag a couple months back, so I know you don't need anything else. But everybody else, send your call to the floor to us at podcast@anyupmagazine.com, and Jordy will answer them. And if we use them on the show, we'll send you something great like a T-shirt from PMS Pokerwear, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the AnnieUp store at antiupstore.com.
Remember a while back when Dave Bloomberg sent us in it was a high hand, bad beat thing, or whatever. It was a bad beat, right, where... Somebody had Jack-Jack, somebody had 10-10, somebody had King-8, and the way the board had played out, it would have been a bad beat somehow. And remember that hand?
Yeah, yeah.
That was a while ago.
Somebody was all in, and they were trying to figure out, had it gone somewhere other way, who would have got the high hand, right?
Right, because it would have been two guys who got bad beat, but another guy who was in the hand, who wasn't in the hand, or it was some weird way of putting it, but... we actually had somebody write in. It was actually the table games manager, John Stewart at Tachi Palace in California. He wrote in because this was in the magazine too, right? It was in the magazine, and we wrote saying that where the dollar went, for the bad beat jackpot, whatever pot that got contributed from, or the two hands that would determine who won the bad beat, or whatever. He says, only the best two hands at showdown qualify for a bad beat jackpot situation. Any players possessing identical first or second best qualifying hands would equally split that portion of the assigned percentage. Therefore, while it is possible for more than two people to hit the jackpot on any given hand, only the top two hand rankings are considered. In this specific situation discussed, both the Jack-Jack and 10-10 have been effectively counterfeited by the King-8. Poker rooms are wise to specifically address this in their written rules. So in other words, the Jack-Jack and 10-10 stayed in, and they both had their aces full cracked by this King-8 somehow. The Jack-Jack would be the one that would have qualified, not the 10-10, because the Jack-Jack was better than the 10-10, and that was the one that was ultimately bad beat. Right? Yep. That's basically what he's saying. So, yeah. Makes sense.
And again, this is the important thing that he reinforced that Jody also mentioned, is that this is something that poker rooms need to have written down.
Yeah.
in the rules. So, you know, when people, because remember, when a bad beat hits, you know, people get excited. There's a lot of emotion. And I've been in a room where somebody thought that they hit a high hand. Whole table went crazy, and the manager had to go over and say, no, you didn't, and here's why. And you almost needed the police security to get out of there that night. And it's a lot easier when it's in written, when it's written down, to show somebody, here is the rule, here is why I ruled it. And then, you know, they're still going to be upset, but at least they can't say that it's not written down. You're just making stuff up on the fly.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. And I think that both John here and Jody said that too. So
very cool.
All right, well, we got some housekeeping to do here. We already mentioned the cruise is coming up at anteupmagazine.com/cruise. But remember, we've got just a couple weeks left in our annual Reader's Choice Survey, the Antes. Go to anteupmagazine.com/survey and have your voice heard and be entered for thousands of dollars of great prizes, including the grand prize of lunch and a one-hour lesson from Chris Moneymaker.
Well, speaking of Moneymaker, remember one of our listeners wrote in, Gene. He said, hey, he wanted to know what people thought the poker world would be like if Sammy Farha had called the bluff of the century. And it wouldn't have been the bluff then. It would have been the poor choice of the century. But if he had called and won the whole thing, what would poker be like? So we're wondering if our listeners want to contribute to that, and we'll bring it up on a future show. Tell us what you think at podcast@anteupmagazine.com, and maybe we'll have a show about it.
And remember, we are always on the look for great ambassadors of the Anteup brand. Specifically, right now, we're looking for folks in Central California, Deadwood, and Louisiana. If you're interested in filling those roles, apply at anteupmagazine.com/ambassadors.
Okay, let's see what happened this week for the Anteup News Desk.
Professional player J.J. Liu and Venetian director of poker operations Kathy Raymond have been selected for induction into the Women in Poker Hall of Fame this year. They'll be officially inducted at a ceremony at the Golden Nugget in Las Vegas on August 31st.
Yeah, that's really cool. You know, we've both had plenty of conversations with Kathy. Very, very smart poker room director, and she's done it all in the industry. She opened Foxwoods. She ran Foxwoods for a long time. She's taken care of the Venetian, made it the mecca that it is. And J.J. Liu, I've actually worked with her personally on that Winning Women of Poker book with her chapter. I helped her write her chapter and edit it. And two very deserving people, I think, to be in the hall.
Yeah, you know, and we mentioned this the Kathy one. We saw her a couple weeks ago at the Venetian. And I try not to get into this whole, you know, first woman to do this, first black president, because I think it minimizes the accomplishment. But I know it's something like that, but we have to admit that the poker is a very male-dominated endeavor, both from the player standpoint and the management and the dealer. And she's got a lot of respect from – there's quite a few female managers out there now, which is good to see. And almost all of them to a person mentioned her when we're talking to her about, you know, how much of a blail she strays for them and make it easier. So, you know. That I think is really cool.
Yep, very good. I'm sorry.
you always read the second one.
Read the second one. When you read. All right, certification.
Cue cards working.
Actually,
bell for Chris.
If we're telling the truth here, you know, Scott works out of his home, I work out of mine, and occasionally we do the show this way through Skype. And we had the file up in front of us, and Scott has the file, and he's manipulating the cursor on the screen, and it's moving around my screen, and I was just mesmerized by it moving around. It's no wonder I don't play slots more often, I gotta tell you. All right, so certification has begun on the first two companies licensed to provide the systems for online poker operators to offer the game to residents of Nevada.
Come on, Chris. Get in the car, Chris. Come on.
Oh man. I'm just watching it go around the screen. I'm like, what is he doing? I forgot to read the next news item.
Good boy, good boy. Way to read that news item. but no, this is a good step here. They're starting to take a look at how these folks that run these things, how their equipment works, and make sure it does work properly and can't be manipulated. And, you know, we still got a ways to go before this is going to happen. But, you know, one of the things that a lot of people mentioned is that, people are really looking at Nevada to be a leader on this because they're really the kind of leader in certification of all kinds of gaming things. So,
yeah.
You know, they're really looking to see how they end up regulating this. And, of course, Delaware has already approved everything, so their next step is to do this too. So it'll be interesting to see if they take any cues from how they do things in Nevada. All right, and finally, we're a little late to the punch on this one, but it's just too rich to ignore. Dan Shack has sued his ex-wife, Beth, saying she hid 1,200 pairs of designer shoes from him that he should receive 35% of the estimated $1 million value of them per their divorce settlement.
We're getting to the soul of the matter here, I think.
Oh, very nice, very nice. And I guess I should say for people that don't know, both of these players are players.
Yeah.
You know, Dan actually has he's a big financial consultant kind of guy, but also plays. And then Beth is a good player in her own right. But, you know, I don't want to get involved in other people's marriage. It's enough trouble just being in my but I think Beth makes a good point. Did Dan really think that she built this secret vault off of the bedroom and hid shoes? And you know what? I don't follow Beth Shack and Dan Shack's life that much. But if you would do that word association game with me and you say Beth Shack, even before the story came out, I would have said crazy in love with shoes. I mean, didn't she have that reputation? I mean, she's been on all these TV shows talking about her shoe collection. She's got this picture of her just kind of like laying on the ground surrounded by all these shoes. This is a shock to him? I don't get it. I don't get it.
I don't get why women like shoes so much, to be honest with you.
I wasn't going to go there, but I totally agree with you on that, too.
I don't understand it.
I got about four pairs of shoes, and they all serve an important function in my footwear needs.
Yeah.
To see a big $1 million worth of shoes, I can't even fathom that. I can't. But that's beside the point here. The point is that they had a divorce, they settled it up, and then all of a sudden, hey, where'd you get these 1,200 pairs of shoes? I need my cut.
I love Scott telling me it's and bringing me back into the point. Mr. Tangent himself saying, hey, let's get back to the point of the shoes here. Scott will go 45 minutes on a parking space in Las Vegas, but I can't say I don't understand why women like so many shoes, but whatever. Let's get back to the point. The point is that Dan Shack wants some more money back. It's funny. Yeah, you're right. I've seen her on other shows, too. I've seen her on the Million Dollar Matchmaker show and you know, talking about her outfits and her shoes and everything. And yeah, you're right, though. I mean, there's no secret here. It's clear that she had all that money. Maybe you just forgot that she, yeah. You know, that could be construed as assets, I guess, which is weird. Because the shoes only go down in value every time you wear them or whatever. It's not like she can reinvest them, you know what I mean, or something. It's kind
of
weird.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never had a pair of designer shoes. I've never paid more than $40 for a pair of shoes in my life. So I don't know. Maybe these Jimmy shoes or whatever the things are called, maybe they do go up in value, you know, like some other things. I don't know. I hope I never know. It's in that whole realm of stuff that I hope I never know that doesn't push out something important like...
Like how to file your taxes.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, we get to kick off a new O'Malley's Move. We got a little twist this time around. It's going to be a three-parter. We will get some resolution next week, but the ultimate payoff won't be for 2 weeks. So let's hear part one.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are seated at a 1-2 no-limit hold'em cash game. There's 10 players at our table, and everyone has a pretty healthy stack, with the largest being north of 800. This table has a bunch of players who love to see lots of flops, and then get it in with anything better than top pair. We're in the small blind, with 575, up about 75. The blinds post, under the gun calls, under the gun +1 and +2 call, The MP1 folds, the MP2 hijack, cutoff, and button all call, and it's finally back to us, in the small blind, with the Ace of Clubs, King of Hearts. Now the proper move here is most definitely a raise to thin the field, right? But we're still a little gun-shy from a few episodes ago when we flopped top-top and folded to a turned straight, losing a bit of money. Couple that with several bad runs when we've been holding Ace-King over the last few sessions, and we make the first mistake of the hand. We limp. The big blind checks his option. Max rake is already achieved. The pot is $13, and we see a beauty. The King of Spades, King of Clubs, 8 of Diamonds, comes on the flop. We've mistakenly played ourselves into a situation where no one could ever put us on Ace-King. We're in good shape here. The only question is, how are we going to play this? We could lead. We could check, planning to check raise. The possibilities are nearly endless. What do we do?
All right, well, Chris jetted home from Las Vegas. I, of course, can't do anything easily. So I trudged on our recent trip and spent 2 nights in New Mexico and then 2 more nights in Colorado visiting poker rooms there, meeting Antioch fans.
And what does he do? He checks his luggage.
I do. Absolutely.
But you got it back.
Lose my luggage once, shame on you. Lose it twice, shame on me. But yes, my luggage made it everywhere. Although I will say, when I landed in New Mexico, the luggage was coming off the belt, right? And it stopped, and the luggage wasn't there. And I'm like, this really, honestly, this cannot be happening. Can you get it? But I did notice a couple other people that were on my flight sitting around looking for their bags. So I'm like, all right. So eventually the bag, the belt started again. Bags came off, and in the middle of it, they announced, hey, the flight from Las Vegas is actually on Carousel 3, and then everybody ran over there, and my bag was the first one off there. But yeah, part of me there, I'm like, oh boy, how stupid can I be? But no, my luggage made it there, and I had a great trip to these two great places, and definitely encourage people to visit both of those locales when they get a chance, because there's something cool. Actually, lots of things cool in both of them. So let's start with New Mexico. You know, if you haven't been there before, there are 4 rooms, all within an easy drive of each other in Albuquerque. And of course, I was doing my Bugs Bunny impressions the entire time I was driving around. Must have turned a wrong turn in Albuquerque.
You sound nothing like him, by the way.
No, sorry. Well, it's the new Bugs Bunny now. You know how Jim Hansen died and doesn't sound like him.
Oh, jeez.
Same thing. But the Inn of the Mountain Gods, which I've heard is a very nice property, is about 3 hours south. And then Buffalo Thunder and Northern Edge, which are smaller rooms, are to the north. But right there in Albuquerque, there are four rooms, pretty easy to get to. I found it's a tournament state there, Chris. People love their tournaments. You know, some places you go, people love to play cash. Some people like to play tournaments. You kind of hope for a mix in most places, but this was truly a tournament area. And most of the managers have lamented that, that they just haven't been able to convert those tournament players into cash players. So they come in, play the tournament, and leave. And, of course, that's not good business for the poker room because, right. You know, they never make any money off the tournaments.
Right.
But, you know, you got to give the players what they want, right?
Yeah.
So, the cash games, this is another one of those areas where the 2-6 spread limit game is common. You know, it's actually not all that far from Laughlin, and I actually did talk to some people that were actually in Laughlin from there. And that's a popular game there too. It didn't shake at all the rooms, but I know at least a couple rooms I was in, the no limit games are uncapped, which I always think is a little bit interesting. I mean, I know the Beau Rivage did that for a while before they changed it, and even when they changed it, the manager was telling me, you know, hey, it doesn't really matter what the chip stacks are. But, you know, I wonder what you think. It's kind of a psychological thing, I guess. Because I asked that when I'm like, you know, hey, what's the min-max? And they almost looked at me weird, like, well, it's a $60 minimum, but you can buy it for whatever you want. And I'm like, oh, no max. So, yeah, and I'm like, oh, okay, well, how much do people usually buy in for? And so it turned out not to be that big a deal. But you know, I was talking to one of the managers, and, you know, we talked about this on the show before. You know that guy that got sentenced to play poker?
Yeah, yeah.
He plays in that room.
Oh, my God.
And he said that's the only guy they ever had that would come in there and buy in for like $5,000 and just bully people. But great story, right?
Wow, you know? Yeah.
But that's what I'm worried about at Uncapped. I'm sitting there with my $100 buy-in that I would normally buy in, or $200 or whatever, and then, you know, some jerk wad sits down with $5,000 and goes all in every hand. That's when you don't like it, yeah. Necessarily. Although that could be a good game, too, you know. But it's not poker at that point, right?
Right.
So that's the danger. But you know, I was assured that other than this one guy, who is obviously back in jail now, so he's not there, that that it does play fairly normal, that you know people don't go crazy with the buy-ins. But maybe I'm old-fashioned, or maybe I'm new-fashioned. I don't know which fashion I am, but I kind of like that cap on those lower-level games. I mean, when you get into 5-10 or even some 2-5, I understand it, but... You know, I think there should be like a 1-2 that's got some protection for players. Should there be?
I think so, and I think the reason why is because the whole point of having a 1-2 game is to have the people who maybe aren't so comfortable playing, but they want to be able to play at a level where they're not going to get crushed. You know, now all of a sudden you've got people there who are just coming in there and bombarding you with huge buy-in and huge pre-flop raises and stuff. And I think that you don't want to discourage your 95% of your audience or your clientele, I mean,
right,
to placate one guy who feels like sitting down as much as he feels like sitting down with that day. I mean, I think there is a reason for the cap, you know, and it's to keep it from getting out of hand and keep people can be competitive. You know, it's hard to be competitive when you got a guy who's got $10,000 in front of him. It's one thing if he sat there and earned it all day long. You know,
yeah.
That's always one of my favorite questions when I get, you know, assigned to a table and I sit down as a guy next to me and I'm buying in for the max at $200 or $300. And he's got like $3,000 in front of him. I always say to him, "How long you been here?" It's always my first question because I want to know: did you win that on like a bad beat? You know, a bonus hand? Did you? And I want to know. I want to know how you earned that money before I'm gonna get tangled with you.
Yeah.
And to me, I'm not afraid to lose my buy-in. I mean, I'm not. If I was afraid to lose it, I wouldn't be sitting down. But at the same time, I don't want to be, you know, abused.
You don't want to know that you have to go all in every hand.
Yeah. Yeah,
or you're going to be put it all in.
I mean, I like the opportunity of knowing that there's a bank over there that I could double up through.
Right, right.
If I make the right hand, the right situation. But it's so rare that those situations always happen in my session that I would rather just have people with the same stacks. My favorite way to play poker is to sit down with 9 other people who we just started the table together.
Right, yeah.
That's my favorite way to play. It just is. I don't know. People may think that's stupid or whatever, but I love that way. I always seem to do better that way. And everyone is on a level ground, level playing field. And,
well, yeah, there's less to think about at that point.
Yeah.
Because you're taking away the chip disparity. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect sense. Now, here's the flip side of this. And I was talking to a manager on this trip that just got back from Florida. And he was like, "No, hey, I went to this casino late at night and went and bought in for the 1-2. And they told me the max was 200. So that's what I bought in for. And I sat down. And everybody at the table had more than $1,000.
Hmm.
And I couldn't be competitive at that point.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right, that's a good point. So, you know, I guess in the dream scenario, I think maybe you need to have a max to kind of protect players, but also allow people to buy in for the maximum stack on the table.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of rooms do that. That way you have the option of you're not forced to be short stacked just late at night when people have been sitting there all day. But I don't know. It's interesting. You know, again, but if it's uncapped and no one really abuses it, then it's probably not that big a deal. But.
Yeah, they do that a lot in Chicagoland area, where they allow you to buy in for the biggest stack at the table.
Yeah.
And that makes some sense, because the hard part is when you're sitting down and you don't want to do that, then you got to make the decision, do I want to play at this table or not? But if you're the type of player that has the money and doesn't want to be bullied by someone with a lot of money, then it's ideal for you. But I don't like the idea of no cap.
Oh, well, the other most amazing thing I saw in New Mexico is every room the rake was $3 max.
And that's cool.
You know, plus a jack draw, of course.
Right.
But I haven't seen any jurisdictions where it's that low. I mean, even in Vegas now, it's $4 at most places. You know, I just haven't seen $3 anywhere. So that's a great value for players, particularly for the lower limit games.
Yeah, that's really good.
All right, I'll run through the four rooms and get some quick thoughts. You know, I stayed at the Hard Rock Albuquerque. Absolutely great hotel. I really enjoyed my room very much. But I got to say, you know, it's one of these rooms that's a connecting room.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The people in the room next to it, I don't know whether they had some kind of baller suite right next to us, but there sounded like there had to be 400 people in there.
Man.
And from what I could tell, one of the girls just turned 21, and their favorite quote was, "I love to drink!" And, you know, hey, people can have fun, right? But I kept checking my little connecting door, make sure it's locked, because I didn't want these people to get drunk and think they're coming to the bathroom or something and, you know, walk in my room. But what's interesting about these people is, you know, I got there pretty late at night, so on a Friday night, you know, so, hey, you know, I'm not going to tell people not to party on a Friday night. And so they were up loud until 2:30 at night. And you know me, I can sleep to a train, right? So
right.
I didn't bother, fell asleep, woke up. Woke up at 8 a.m. They were still going.
Oh, my God.
I wish I could go back in time and have that energy.
Oh, my God.
There was only one time the entire time I was there that I did not hear them partying.
Wow. That's amazing. Crazy.
Absolutely, yeah, amazing.
That's remarkable.
Kids these days, the stamina. But the poker room, you know, a lot of the poker rooms in this area were separate from the, or doored off of the casino, so not very far away, but at least they were shut. Actually, this one at Hard Rock, they actually had kind of like a, I don't know what you call it, kind of like a weird glass, so you can barely see in, but when you open it up, you know, so it's kind of cool. But I like those rooms that are separate, because, you know, it keeps the smoke out, keeps the sound out.
Yeah.
And, it was done well. They had a great menu there with reasonable food prices. I got a green chili burger. Because, you know, I'm in New Mexico, right?
Right.
Now, the manager there, Dave Holliday, says that they have the biggest turnout for their major tournaments in the area. But, you know, there are nothing tournament series there. He does just one big tournament, but draws more than 500 people for him. So, if you're looking for big fields, they do pretty well there. And then he also made a point of saying almost all their dealers are homegrown. And there's only two on his staff, I think he said, that weren't native from New Mexico.
That's
and
cool.
They were really good. So, I mean, I think that speaks well, because obviously you're being well-trained there if you didn't learn somewhere else and input yourself in. So, from there, I went up to the Santa Ana Star. They don't have a manager there, but Michael Gerard is one of the floors. And I thought he was one of the more interesting people I met that in my travels that are running a room, or sort of running a room, whatever the deal is there. He's played professionally in the past. At pretty high stakes. He also owned a couple businesses too, and so now he's applying the lessons he learned from both of those to running this room, you know, so trying to make a player friendly room, but also, you know, operating it as a business, and really trying hard to get the word out about what they do better. They actually had this interesting flyer, you know, when you walk in, they always have, you know, here's the tournaments we have tonight, here's the promotions, right?
Right.
They had a flyer that compared them to competitor A. You know, down to the rake, down to the comps, down to the tournament structures, which I thought was kind of a ballsy move.
Yeah.
And, of course, you could figure out who competitor A was pretty closely if you were there. But you know, I see this frustration. I know you do, too, when you travel with me. There's rooms that people are doing everything right, but for whatever reason, they just can't get players to come in.
Yeah.
And that's a tough thing, I think.
Yep.
You know, I don't know. You know, what should you do at that point when, you know, usually you can tell somebody, well, you know, you need to offer a better product. Well, if you're offering a better product, people still work. Before, you offered even a better product at that point? Is that going to really make a difference? So we'll be interested to see what happens there. But that was another one of them that was kind of a separate doored off area from the rest of the casino. From there, I went down to Sandia, which is the busiest room in the region. Everybody was talking about this room. They had a good variety of games going on. It was a big, large room. They are the top dog there.
Hmm.
And then the last one I went to, Route 66, or is it Route 66?
Route.
What do you say?
It's Route.
I got into this discussion with one of my friends in Pennsylvania at the beginning of this whole trip, and she made me take one of these... regional vernacular kind of things,
yeah.
Or judges how Dixie you are based on this stuff. And this is one of the things. I mean, some places they call it route, and some places they call it route. You call it route.
Well, you know why? Because think about the song too. You get your kicks on, and it's not Route 66. They say route. So I hear the song too, so it makes you think. If they say it in a song, I should probably say it that way. So I don't know, but I grew up saying
that's your bar.
That's my bar.
Sing it like it is.
If it's
song.
In a music song, if it's in a song somewhere, that's
the bar for Chris Cassidy. Okay.
But I did grow up saying root. We said root. Same thing with like paper root. We didn't say paper. Sometimes some people would say paper route though, even though, you know, I think the root comes with you know, route, R-O-U-T, is no other way to say that is route. So when the E is added, people think you have to say route, maybe. I don't know. I have no idea.
Well, you could say routee.
Routee. Routee.
All right, I'm going to call it route. So,
okay, you're going to call it route.
But I'm not going to criticize you for saying route because you heard the song, because that's obviously a very good bar.
Yeah.
All right, but Route 66, it's an Irish pub theme room. This might be the first one I've seen like this. It had a lot of, you know, Irish pub signs up. They did the theme very well. And it's behind the Irish bar there, which actually was kind of hard to find. You know how we always joke when we walk into a casino, we look for the sports book because we know it's going to be there. Obviously, There's no sports books in New Mexico. But I walked around the whole casino like 3 times because, you know, I'm a guy and I'm incapable of asking for directions. And then eventually I saw that the Irish pub was called the Poker Pub or something. I'm like, I wonder if that's close to the poker room. And you walk into the bar, and then behind the bar is the poker room. But kind of cool. They're getting ready to do the Heartland Poker Tour there this month. So we'll be interested to see how that draws there, because Heartland's a little far away from their home base there.
Right.
But good manager doing some good stuff there. Now, we did have a mini meetup that night. Early in the day, I did have lunch with Zorag and his family, cute kids.
Yeah.
And his wife is awesome, too. I'm Facebook friends with her. And it's always good to hang out with him. I asked a lot of good questions about the company and told me a little bit more about New Mexico and stuff. So that was really cool. So it was kind of two mini meetups, you know, one there. Then we did the actual meetup that night. We weren't expecting a lot of people, but our ambassador, New Mexico Ambassador Mary Bradley and her husband showed up and had a good dinner with them. And, you know, we played the 7 o'clock tournament at the Hard Rock where I was staying there. And, you know, in a previous show, I was talking about that Caesars tournament that was $80.
Yeah.
And this one was 65 or so. And, you know, I don't know whether the play here in Florida is that much better or the play in these other places is not so much or what. But in both of these tournaments, I felt like I was playing like one of these $25 tournaments. It was that kind of level of play. I mean, the people that were attracting, and it wasn't that. So I ended up bubbling in fourth, which, of course, you know, nothing worse than in a 20-some player tournament to go all the way to fourth and get knocked out and get absolutely nothing for it, no save or anything, and walked out. But it was a good tournament. I had a good time, and, you know, Mary didn't make it that far. But we got some good representation there, and
cool.
Neat little area. From there, though, then I flew up to Denver and went to Blackhawk, where they had 5 rooms there. It's about 30, 45 minutes west of Denver, depending where you come in. And there is one other room in Cripple Creek, which is the other casino area, but that's south of the city, closer to Colorado Springs. But all the Blackhawk rooms are literally within a 1 or 2 minute walk of each other. But what was amazing to me was we get to the first night and got there kind of late and just stayed at the Isle Blackhawk where I was staying. Lady Luck, but all the same. And we had our meetup and stuff, and I didn't get out to explore until the next day. So I was talking to people in the room there, and they were like, "Oh yeah, you know, people just don't want to come down this far, and all the other action's up farther up." So I thought that, you know, the next morning when I got up to walk, that I was going to have to hoof it. The other rooms, well, no, they're literally 2 minutes away from each other. So people there just are, I don't want to say spoiled, that's the wrong word, but I mean, they just, you know, geography's relative, I guess.
Right.
You know, in Vegas, you know, you have a room next to each other, and it's like a mile between the poker by the time you walk back out to the strip and walk back in through all the, you know, the slot machines and stuff. There, literally, you know, I could get drunk at one and roll down the hill and hit the other one. But you know, there seems to be some kind of barrier there for people where they just don't want to walk that 2 minutes. But quite the opposite of New Mexico. This is a cash game state. You know, only one room in Blackhawk has consistent tournaments. All the other ones, it's almost all cash games. And so again, it's real interesting. I mean, it was a 1 hour flight from Albuquerque to Denver, but completely different poker setup.
Jeez.
And probably the reason that it's a cash game place, it's absolutely bad beat insane. I put crazy in the notes, but it's insane there. You know, back when we started the magazine, we started talking about, you know, what's the threshold for posting something on the website for a bad beat, and I think we decided like on 100,000, and maybe we've upped it since then.
Right.
But here they said, several of the managers told me that the players won't even get out of bed for a bad beat jackpot less than 300,000.
Man.
Now, 300,000 is astronomical in almost every jurisdiction that I can think of. Occasionally, there's one that gets bigger than that. But 300,000, you've got a bad beat that that people are coming from miles away for. There, that's what they seed them at.
Jeez.
So when I was there, one room was over 600,000 for the bad. 500,000. I mean, that's amazing, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it is. So what are, do you know the qualifiers? Are they so yeah, hard well, to hit?
What they do is they have, they actually, which was kind of different there from other places, I think, is they have multiple tiers. So you've got like a, you know, the big tier is quads beat my quads, and it's a high quads. It might even be like quad eights beaten.
Jeez.
And then they've got like a, every room is a little different, but then that second tier might be a smaller quad beaten. And then the third tier might be aces full of kings beaten or aces full of queens or something. And you get a, you know, the smaller tiers, you obviously get a smaller piece of the whole thing. So, yeah, I guess it gets up big because of the harder qualifier. What was interesting in New Mexico is that the one room there had a $125,000 bad beat, and the qualifier was aces full of queens.
Jeez.
That was pretty easy.
Yeah.
To beat. So it just, you know, it's just timing. But yeah, if you're looking for bad beats, book your flight to Denver tomorrow. they always have big bad beats there. I mean, and you know, all of them do like, you know, room shares or table shares or something like that. So I mean, there's potential of winning some good money just for being in the right place at the right time, not even being involved in the hand really.
That's insane. And I know they have that $100 bet limit, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's probably another reason why the bad beats are so good there, because people know they're not going to lose that much sitting around trying to hit it.
Yeah, and this was the first time I've been to a place that had that. Well, I guess Minnesota did. I played a little bit, but with a $100 bet limit. And, you know, one of the interesting side notes I got from talking to one of the managers was that, you know, he had come from Vegas too and thought this was weird like the rest of us do. But when he took some time to study and watched it, he's like, you know, this is actually not a bad thing. You know, it protects our players. They don't go broke. And this is one of my big criticisms with people insisting on playing no limit rather than limit, because in limit, you can manage your risk a lot better.
Yeah.
And your money, I mean, not guaranteeing you're going to win, but your money by nature is going to last longer than in a no limit game. And when people go broke, then games break, right? And people don't have, you know, if one guy in the town has all the money, then there's no games coming up. So. So, you know, having the $100 bet limit doesn't necessarily keep you from losing everything, but it does have some kind of artificial control on you. And to be honest, I played, you know, one whole night, and there was twice that I think someone bet 100. All the other bets were usually less than that. So, of course, that's a very small sample size, but, you know, I didn't see a lot of people really wanting to bet more than 100 ever. But the other thing this manager says is it actually helps protect the casino too. You know, you get a big whale that comes in and bets $100,000 on a hand of blackjack and wins. You know, it destroys your profits for a month. I mean, we see that in Vegas all the time. But when all you can bet is 100, you know, the casino's not going to get hurt.
Yeah, well, I guess there's the other side of that too, right? You're not going to win a lot either.
Well, true. Yeah, but I mean, really, the ultimate point is, the players are going to continue to have money to be able to play, and the casino is going to continue to be able to offer because they're not going to get hit hard. And it overall keeps the economy going there, which is an interesting point that I hadn't thought about. So
yeah.
All right, let me run through the rooms real quick. Isle Blackhawk, it's the newest room. Still trying to find its place in the market out there. You know, it's always tough when you're the new kid on the block. You know, people are, particularly poker players, you know, they're regulars at rooms, and you know, not that they're necessarily loyal, but you got to get them away from where they play. So they're still trying to figure that out. They're doing some cool stuff like free hot dogs and soup to players. But I was like, they're not comps or not from your comp points. You know, you make comps on top of that. But
I love that.
Yeah, so I was in there. I mean, I did have dinner the night of the meetup, so a couple hours in, one of the guys at the table ordered a tequila shot and a hot dog. And I thought he was just kidding because he was kind of like flirting with the waitress in a way. But then she bring him a hot dog. And I'm like, hey, I want two of those. And then everybody at the table ordered two hot dogs. So. But, you know, that's always nice. Rick. I like to have free food. They do have a deal with the World Poker Tour for these regional events. They had one already that apparently did pretty well. They have another one coming up in October. And, you know, they're kind of using that to try to get the word out that they're there. But again, it's 2 minutes away from the other room, so it's interesting that it's that hard to get people to come down.
Yeah.
2 minutes. But attached to the Isle Black Hawk is the Lady Luck. That room's been around for a while. Deb Johnson runs it. One of the nicest managers of the match. She was absolutely fantastic. But it's connected to the Isle, but they do everything separate, so they don't work together at all. This is one of the things that I think you and I are seeing when we're traveling. It's so weird that these companies that share ownership don't use that to their advantage.
Yeah, they don't help each other.
They almost make their properties compete against each other, yeah. Which doesn't seem like it makes sense to me. But the poker room's on the second floor next to table games, and she's like, you know what? All these other rooms are going after these $100 bet max players. I want to be the low limit room, and her most popular game is a $2 to $10 spread limit. And she's had players that have been there for years with her. So if you're going there and you don't want to play the no-limit game, Lady Luck is where you're going to want to go. Hmm. And then right next door is the Golden Gates, and this is the big tournament house in town. I think they run four a day.
Jeez.
They also host the Heartland Poker Tour twice a year, and then I think three other times a year they have something called the Colorado Poker Championships. And it's a large Old West kind of theme room. It's separate from the casino, but it's got its own restrooms and a bar and grill inside. Don't get a lot of cash games going, but if you're a tournament player, this is where you're going to want to camp out, and you could be there all day playing tournaments. Again, it's an interesting market where, you know, one room gets the tournament business and the other one's still. And then continue up the hill, you go to the Lodge. It's on the second floor next to table games and slots. The new manager, I didn't get a chance to meet with him because he's on vacation, but he was the old tournament director of the Venetian Lodge, right? And so I think he's just taken over too. So, you know, by the time folks listen to the show, there might even be something new about the room. So I don't want to tell too much about it and make it all wrong. But it was a nice looking room. And then next door is the Ameristar, which is the Sandia of Blackhawk, the busiest room for cash games. And in fact, that's all they do there. They don't run any tournaments at all. They're like, you know, hey, we got plenty of cash game business, so there's no reason for us to run tournaments here. You know, we'll run full spread on the weekend. For a casino, that's the best thing you want to hear.
Yeah.
Because you don't make any money on tournaments. So if you can have a good cash game business, that's great. They also have a regular 30-60 game there, which I've told people come from states away to play because it's an action game. And to be honest, you can't find a 30-60 game, really, too many places these days. You know, it might be one or two places in Vegas, a couple places in California, maybe Minnesota, maybe in Atlantic City, too, maybe. But outside of that, it's hard to find big limit games like that anymore.
And you sat right down, right?
Of course,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And then I'm like,
crushed.
Yeah, give me $100 a rack point. And like, no, it's a 30-60, not a 3-6. But it's a very nice room, very well done. The casino is very nice there, too. So you'll have a good time there. And, you know, buffet and deli, everything really close. Now, unlike Vegas, where I didn't get to play very often, I did have a couple sessions on this trip here. I won a little bit in the 4-8 half kill game at the Ameristar. Playing with the my elders, I will say. because it's really the low limit game. It's kind of funny to think of a 4-8 half kill game as being the low limit game in a market, but it is there. But fun game, had a good time. And then I went over to the Golden Gates and played their nightly tournament. And unlike where I bubbled in fourth in New Mexico, I actually finished third there and got unstuck from the money I lost at the meetup the night before. But very interesting is they allow people to register through level 8. And, you know, I know as soon as I got off the plane, I was telling you, I'm like, dude, you got to see this place. It's level 8. And we figured that was, what, 2 or 3 hours?
Yeah, it's like 2.5 hours or something.
Plus you have re-entries, too. So if you get knocked out, you can... And, you know, the great thing for a player, I think, is it gets the player, the prize pool up.
Yeah.
You know, this tournament started with, I think, 2 tables, maybe 3. And we ended up with 44 entrants, so, you know, they were able to pay 5 spots, whereas if you didn't do any of that or you cut off, you know, late registration after the first level or two, like most places do, it would have been a, you know, 25-player tournament. So
it makes a difference. I mean, if you're in Denver and you know a tournament starts at noon and it's like 11:10 or 11:40, even, you know, somewhere in that half-hour range, you know, it's not that big of a deal now because you know, okay, you're going to... you're not going to make the start of the tournament, but you're going to have plenty of time to get there to actually get into the tournament. Whereas right. if you only have an hour to kill, you know, something hit traffic or something like that, you might miss that first hour or the first level, which is only 20 minutes. You know, it just depends on how you know what I'm saying. It just yeah. depends on how many they want to set it at. But level 8, that's huge.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it makes it more convenient for players. I mean, I'm trying to figure what the downside is. I mean, there were players when I was playing that were like, man, they're still letting people in. And they're like, oh, yeah, through level 8. And, so I guess when you sit down to the actual start of the tournament, it does get frustrating when you knock somebody out and then somebody else sits right back down on that table when you got knocked that person out. And somebody else sits back down, maybe the same guy that you just knocked out. But I don't know whether that's really a bad thing. I mean, I couldn't come up with a reason why I didn't like it other than just it was out of the ordinary.
Yeah, 8 levels. That's incredible. I've never
heard
of that.
In the end, you want a big
that.
Prize pool, right? You know?
Yeah, and you want, exactly right. You want as much money as possible. And I mean, there is this sort of feeling of accomplishment that you're whittling the field down, you know, until you're going to be in the money. But instead, just keep filling the seats. It feels like it's an unending process. You know, and when you play these dailies too, you're hoping to get out of there in a couple hours too. You know,
that's true. It is. It could be a longer tournament. Yeah, that's true. It depends on what you like, but yeah.
But the pluses clearly outweigh the minuses in my mind.
Well, you know, the other thing too is, I finished third in this. I mean, one of the things that I thought was really cool, I walked away. I'm like, you know what? There were people that bought in twice, sometimes three times in this tournament.
Yeah.
And I outlasted them with my first buy-in. So I mean, in terms of a sense of accomplishment. It is more accomplishing, I guess.
Yeah.
To be in a tournament where people keep taking shots and keep leaving, you know. But definitely different. So, now of course we did the meetup the first night. Early in the day, I went to the Rockies game with a longtime listener Ryan Gibbs, and we're about 4 feet from the sun because we're in Denver. So you know our faces were melting off like the Nazis and Raiders of the Lost Ark, and but you know I loved the. Ryan is, if remind the folks, and maybe even you, he was the guy that got in that car accident and then got out and dealt with the police and other people, blah, 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 got back in the car, and we were still yapping on the show.
Yeah.
It was a great story, and a great guy. Got to meet his wife and one of his friends and had a good time at the game, and then we went to the meetup, which was just Ryan and Phil, who was at our Palms meetup
right.
a year ago in Vegas. Great guy, too. We talked about getting a mixed game going, but we would have had to break their no-limit table, and that wasn't going to happen. So we just played the 1-2, I guess it's 1-2, 100 no-limit, I guess you call it there.
Yeah.
And that didn't do well. I dropped a bunch of money. I think so did Ryan. At one point, we met at the ATM and talked about whether we should go have some fun somewhere else or whether we should continue playing. And Ryan made a good point. He's like, you know what? This game is beatable. We had a woman there that sat down she had about $400 or $500 in front of her and was playing absolutely crazy. We had a couple other players that just weren't very good. And I think he made a good point. You know, when you're sitting in a good game, why leave? You know, if you're just getting unlucky or things aren't going your way, you know, you don't want to leave that game and go to a tougher game.
Yeah. And I think we've talked about that on the show, too, where if you're unlucky is one thing. If you're playing bad or they're better than you, then it's an idea to get up and go. But if it's just getting unlucky, you know, then the variance and everything else is going to catch up and you're gonna perform. So that's what you did? You guys went back and bought back in?
Yeah, we both played and both lost again. So, yeah.
Shocking.
I'll end the main topic this week with a great line from Phil was right across from me and we were just chatting like we always do about the company, the show, and all that stuff. And so this came like an hour of conversing back and forth. And I should say we have a really great table there too. I mean, there weren't a lot of Antioch fans there, but everybody was talking and having a good time, which I always like. So we were talking, and you know how this goes. You know, you have a conversation, and then one or both of you ends up in hand, and you're quiet for a while, and then, you know, somebody thinks of something, you know. So, you know, we've been talking for a while, been quiet for a while, then it just out of the blue, he's like, so, do both of your wives work? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely, and we keep talking, and then I'm like, about 20 minutes into this, I'm like, wait a minute. No one else at the table knows what he means. No one else at the table knows that he's talking about Chris's wife and my wife. So I better clarify for the table, hey,
guys,
I'm not from Utah.
I don't have two wives. Right?
I don't have a reality show on TLC.
And it was funny. Everybody started laughing, and I could tell they were sitting there for 20 minutes thinking the same thing that I just realized at that point, that here's this guy that works this magazine, and he's got wives all over the place. And he's making them all work while he's out playing poker. What a jerk.
That's pretty funny. So the reality show isn't going to come anytime soon then for you then.
No, all right. I don't think so. But
well, I'm glad you got your luggage and I'm glad you're back safe, buddy.
Yeah, it's a good travel, and I think I'm going to take it easy here for another month or so before I'm back on the road.
Hi, this is Greg Raymer, better known as the Fossil Man, and you are listening to Annie Up.
Alright, it's always a great day here at Annie Up headquarters when I get to subject my good friend Chris to an Omaha Hand of the Week.
You know, is Omaha 8 or is it Omaha?
I'll tell you later on.
Oh, man.
No, I'm pretty sure it's Omaha High. It's Omaha High.
So okay, I can appreciate that game a little more.
It's just not it's the 8 that you
you
get your panties in a bunch of.
Yeah, it's the 8 that drives me crazy.
All right. Comes from our good friend, Rick Santoro, who has been a frequent contributor. We always like his stuff. And this hand comes from his small stakes home game on the Jackasses of Poker Tour, which I think we talked about when he was first on there. You know, we should be, if we're not already, honorary members.
Yeah, I think you're the mayor of the Jackasses of Poker
Tour. And you're catching up to me very quickly on this show. all right, so he says, this is a cheap example of where not to be results-oriented. See, we've already disappointed most of our listeners now because he's already taken the results-oriented away from us.
Yes.
Probably it could be the quickest hand of the week in history. all right, so here's what he says. Again, it's a small stakes home game. They play blinds are 25 cents, 50 cents, or a quarter, two quarter. I'm going to call it that. That sounds more fun.
Interesting.
But they do play at no limit.
Okay.
We'll talk about that later. And apparently it's dealer's choice, and the dealer calls Omaha High for this hand. And the dealer's new to Omaha, but he likes it. My favorite kind of Omaha dealer. Hey, let's play that Omaha game. That's fun.
Yeah.
Love when that happens in the home game. all right, so 7 players, and we are under the gun, plus 2. We have 83 Skittles in our stack up from the 50 that we started with.
That's good.
And it is folded to us, and we look down at King of Spades, King of Clubs, 8 of Spades, 8 of Clubs.
Wow, double suited. Two pair kings.
Double suited double pair.
Man.
DPDS?
Double pair, double suited.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. What do we do here?
It's folded to us. Got 2 chances to hit a flop, so it's basically 1 in 4 to hit, you know, a set. We also have the second nut flush draws for 2 suits. And we have a pretty big pair, which is only being beaten by 1 pair. And it's folded to us, which means there's only a few people behind us. It's a 7-player hand. So I'm going to raise, and since it's no limit, I'll make it like 150, $2, something like that.
All right. Yeah, I'm not usually a big fan of these DPDS hands.
Right.
Because in Omaha, again, I think the set is completely overrated. Now, of course, as you mentioned, we have kings, which is the second biggest pair, so that helps a little bit. But again, this is a game of nuts.
Yeah.
It's a little less when it's just Omaha High. But, you know, still, you got to think about the nuts here. And we have a nut hand here.
Yeah, we don't have a nut hand.
We've got 2 flush draws that will be second nuts, which is the kiss of death.
Yeah.
And 2 pairs that could be flop sets, the eights. I would never get excited flopping a set of eights in Omaha. King's a little different story,
right.
But it's to me it's a damaged hand. It's one of those, as our good friend Lou Krieger would say, you know, the 4 stools of the 4 legs of the stool.
Right.
And it's a debatable on how strong those four legs are here. There's four legs. I'll give you credit for that. But they're made by Scott Long and Shop Class, not by Amish woodmakers.
Well, you know, I agree. But here's the deal is, if we're under the gun plus two, that means two people have folded, two are in the blinds. There's really only two people with hands that we have to really, really concern ourselves with. So if we do make a raise and it gets to the blinds, we generally think that we're good pre-flop with this hand. So I don't mind raising, and I don't mind even, you know, the kings being the, you know, the catalyst of this action for me. I know what you're saying, though. Obviously, you don't want to go into, because it is a game of nuts, because everyone's getting four cards, and if they're choosing to play a hand, they probably have a suited ace, and it could be in our suit, and we're screwed, or whatever. But I do like this hand, shorthanded like this, and no limit.
Yeah. What I was going to eventually get to is, I don't like this hand, but I'm going to raise with it.
Yeah, yeah.
For all the reasons you mentioned, I'm just going to be very cautious about how excited I get with how the flop plays out. I'm happy taking the blinds here.
Yeah.
And if nothing else, get heads up and fire that good old continuation bet. And because there's no limit, we've taken the entire purpose of Omaha away from this hand, and we can just obliterate someone with a bigger bet on the flop if we had to.
Right.
But you're right. I'm gonna bump this, maybe even as much as $2 here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was thinking, between 150 and two. So, yeah, maybe two, just because you don't want somebody just in the blinds getting a decent price to call with some raggedy ace or something.
Right. All right, well, our hero raises to $1.75.
Oh, there you go. That's right in between what we said.
Not bad. Said. And yeah. He says he has a decent hand with set possibilities and two king high flushes. One set possibility. I just wanted
to... Yeah. Wait, because you don't like a set of eight is not good? What if it came 8-5 deuce?
Yep, and then there's a straight draw out there, and I guarantee you it's going to run you down.
Okay, but still, I mean, I wouldn't frown on an 8-4 deuce flop, I gotta tell you.
Well, not no limit, Omaha, I wouldn't.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. So this is no limit.
Yep. You're right.
So there's two sets.
All right, he says, I like it, but there are no nut hands. Yay! because of this, I don't want to start out with too big of a pot. See, I don't know. I'm trying to end this thing, and I'm trying to really make people make a big decision here. So,
yeah.
If you pick a pot out of this, then I think you need to fold it.
Yeah.
He says, if I pick up a draw, I will try for a continuation bet to get value. However, whoa, wait a minute. What draw are you picking up here?
He's thinking the second nuts is going to be good four-handed.
He just said, but there are no nut hands, and then he's looking for a draw. Rick. He says, if I pick up a draw, I'll try for a continuation bet to get value. However, if I miss on a fairly dry board where my kings could still be best, I don't want to be in a spot where I have to bet big in order to price out any draws that may have materialized.
Yeah, what if ace of spades, jack of spades, four of diamonds comes on the flop? Now he's picked up the nut draw.
Okay, all right.
Wait, I'm just trying to help Rick out here. It's true.
Would we invite Rodney Dangerfield over? We're playing this game in fantasy land now?
Hey, he said if. That exonerates him from anything. If I pick up a draw or whatever. So that is a draw. Ace of spades comes out with another spade. He's got a draw. Or clubs.
You know, Back to School was on TV the other day, and I turned it on, like, Back to School's on, yay! And my wife just rolled her eyes. She's like, oh my gosh.
Well, back to the point, Scott.
Back to the point. Back to the shoes. I don't know why women always be buying shoes.
Oh my God.
All right, so it's folded around to the button who calls, as does the big blind. Our pot now is $550. Our villain stacks are Squiggly $37 and Squiggly $42. Doesn't say
We don't know. We have 83 we started with.
We have, yeah. Okay. We look down at our chips. We can always count our own
chips.
Yeah,
that's true, yeah.
All right, the flop is King of Hearts, Trey of Hearts, Jack of Clubs, and we are first to act.
$10.
With our top set, no draws.
$10. Put it out there.
You're like way over betting the pot, right?
Yeah, because, you know, a pot bet in Omaha, someone's going to call with two hearts. Someone's going to call with queen 10. Someone's going to call with ace, queen, you know, or something. So We do have a backdoor club draw, but I want to end this pot right now, and I don't want to just bet pot. I want to bet more than the pot. I want to make sure that these guys know that they're going to be betting about a third of their stack to try to make their draw here. And if they're not, if they're just poor players, then I'm getting them to call with obviously the worst hand because I've got the best hand possible at this point.
Yeah, I might not go as crazy as you are, but I do see value in overbetting the pot here. So maybe $7, $7.50. It depends on how the chips are. If I could bet $7.49,
make it really big.
That would be awesome. Impressive. Just shoving them in, chips falling everywhere.
Intimidate them with your stack size.
Exactly. our hero bets $4.
Boo! I feel like that's not enough.
Yeah. Yep.
If it was limit, nothing else you could do. You're cornered. But here, you could really make these people pay, and it's a pretty decent pot right now. $5 in a 25-cent, 50-cent game. You know, I'd be
caps
happy.
Off, and I'm loving it.
Oh man! All right. This poker game is like Sunday church. Caps off.
All right, so both the button and the blind call. Yeah, see, this is exactly what we don't want.
No, and we're out of position, too.
We got two people drawing, although I don't know. Yeah, probably maybe a Broadway draw and a heart draw here, and maybe multiple of it. And, of course, probably somebody might have aces, too, you know, so pick up that ace and Dorcas as well, too. Just because of how it's going to work out. Because we're going to be result-oriented with this hand, by the way, remember.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so I figure there's a good chance that the hero draws. Yeah.
Yeah.
That crystal ball is working well for you.
Right? Yeah.
Now, you know, what we don't know is had we bet more, whether that would have scared people out. You know, what I really wanted to do this hand is have somebody go, are you serious, Scott? $7.50. Oh, my God, Chris, $10. Are you serious? I got a good draw, but I'm not going to pay that much and muck their hand. Thank you.
Thank you. Give me my $5.50.
Absolutely. By $4, they're going to be like, all right, got to run you down. Got to run you down.
Yeah.
All right, pot's now 17.50. Turn is the 10 of hearts. So our board now is king of hearts, tray of hearts, jack of clubs, 10 of hearts. The entire world came in.
Brutal.
We're thinking that $4 bet now, aren't we, Rick?
Yeah, that's brutal.
And we are first act.
No, we're second act, right? It's a blind.
Oh,
big blind.
Oh, yeah, I guess. All
right. So what did the big blind do?
That's right, because I'm sorry, the flop was checked to us. All right, yeah. All right, so it's checked to us.
Okay, I check.
Yep. We do, and it's checked behind us.
Oh, good. Free card to hit our boat or quads.
We're going to need it. All right, so he starts thinking, are they hanging in there with one pair of hands? A smaller set? Perhaps something like king-queen for top pair in the straight draw? Someone would bet their flush here, wouldn't they?
You'd think.
Well, here's the thing. If it's a small flush from the big blind, I'm not betting that.
Yeah.
Because I got to think, I mean, you got to put yourself, again, now this is a low-limit home game, so I'm not going to try to get too academic here. But in a normal Omaha game, if I have a small flush and I'm in the big blind, I got to think about the action going on. I'm not worried about our hero here who's been betting this thing pretty big. But the other guy that just called has to be on a draw, and this hand hit him. Now, I'm hoping that it hit him on the straight part and not the flush part, but I don't want to put a bet out here. Maybe have our hero not realize what's going on and raise, and then have this other guy get involved and make this pot too big. I'm going to check and hope there's a little pot control here and hope my baby flush holds up.
Well, let me ask you this now. If I replay this hand and I'm the baby flush in the big blind, when the bet comes out at $4 and the button calls, why would we call if we're not going to with a baby flush after that action?
Well, because it could be a straight draw as well, too.
Okay, so
no, admittedly, it's a terrible position to be in.
Yeah, it's just terrible.
So yeah, there would be a big moment of clarity there for me. I mean, there could be other things going on here, too, you know. Maybe we have ace 10 in our hand, too, plus the flush draw.
Yeah, right. So we had the straight draw and the baby flush draw. We got the baby flush, but we were hoping for the straight.
We got both, and we ended up, you know, obviously our better hands is the baby flush.
Baby flush, yeah.
Could be. So, I don't know. I mean, we're getting off track here, you know.
Well, that's the whole point of the show.
We need to finish up this hand so I can go buy some shoes. But no, my overall point is I don't think that you can immediately eliminate the fact that no one has a flush here because they didn't bet.
Right.
And remember, there's also some, you know, bait in a trap here too. You know, maybe somebody's willing to take the risk that you're not going to boat up, or even that you may not even have a set right now, and then put that false confidence in your mind. Hey, all right, well, I checked around. Yay, I'm in the clear.
Yeah.
And bet out, and then boom.
Yeah. And they spring like a
absolutely.
Like a tiger.
Yeah. At this point, I'm just happy that I didn't have to put any more money into this pot. And you're right. I get the free look. Hopefully, I can boat up here, and then I'll feel a lot more confident about where I am.
Yep.
All right. So, pot 1750, the river is the five of hearts, so our final board is king of hearts, tray of hearts, jack of clubs, ten of hearts, five of hearts, Mr. Boat, and the big blind wakes up for $5.
Wow, so this changes nothing, really. This five changes absolutely nothing, because the hearts were already there, and no other straight draws or anything else gets there, so the five can't beat us. So we're either beat, or we're...
It's out there, absolutely. Yeah.
All right, so he bets $5, and there's five out there, so there's 10, 50 out there now. We're getting 2-1 on our money with top set.
No, it's 17-15 in the pocket.
I mean, I'm sorry, I forgot, because he bet...
22.50.
So we're getting a ton on our money. We're getting 5-1 on our money, right? Or 4-1.
Right now. Yeah. And we don't know what's going to happen because we got the guy behind us. Stack.
I'm going to call. Agreeing with me? What?
No, my decision here is based on, and again, this is a home game, so you know the players better. If I know that guy that left the act to me is probably just going to call, or there's a reasonable assumption that he's not going to raise and make me put more money in here. Yeah, I'll put $5 in here to see if my, you know, if one of these people is overbetting, you know, a two pair or some kind of weird combination. I can't imagine I'm good here. Is the other thing, though.
Yeah, the other.
And look at this board. I just don't know what somebody would bet here that we can beat, unless it's a smaller set. I mean, maybe it could be a set of fives, set of tens. Maybe, but I would have to know the home game players that to know that. But again, I'm giving my good friend Gundam a lot of credit here. You know, without any additional information, we have to assume people are playing how we assume they would play.
Right.
In an Omaha game here, I would assume if somebody's going to lead out into this pot here, they have to have a hand that's better than what we have.
Well, I don't know. The check. If they're an inferior player, and we know that they're inferior, like you said, a check.
That's new information. That's
yeah,
what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. It's the home game. The guy knows, hey, you know what? This guy likes to play a lot of two-pair hands, or maybe thought I was just, you know, getting crazy on the flop, and then we all calmed down on the turn, and now he's just trying to buy this pot. And that's completely different. And like I said, the guy behind me is not going to call. I mean, you know, we're talking $5 here. I mean, I'm willing to take that gamble here to see what hand... But I'm not willing to put more than $5 in this pot.
Yeah.
And I'm not willing just to sacrifice five. No, now if I think there's a good chance the guy behind me is going to raise, because then I'm just throwing that $5 away.
Exactly. That's what I need. Exactly. You have to know that. And it seems to me, the way the betting went, that if this guy on the button had a hand that he could raise with, he would have done it already when he got check on the turn, because the five didn't change anything. So I feel like a call here might be safe, and I can find out if this guy just in the big blind doesn't understand the game well enough, and I'll keep to be able to file that away, or if he did have a baby flush. But it really feels like the button behind me is not going to raise if I call $5.
That's kind of my based on the information I have, that's what I would say too.
Yeah.
So the $5 in here. All right, so he says about the big blind's action, this is a strange card to bet. I'm beating a rivered set, and regardless, I can't imagine anyone would bet out with a set or a straight, considering that there's a possible flush. I was already behind a flush on the turn, so the river didn't change anything. I just wanted to show down my kings and call the $5. Yeah?
Yeah.
I don't know what anybody else could have besides a flush, but that set of kings sure looked good. All right, you know, we're all on the same page here. The button min raises to $10, and the big blind 3-bets to $15.
Holy cow. Well, now I'm out.
Yeah.
I mean, well, now I have to go out.
No, you would have to drug me and beat me senseless. to put another dollar in this pot. So, all right. So he says, "Yikes! Someone must have been slow playing a flush." You think? I couldn't really call $10 more here. Not to mention that I wouldn't be closing the action. I could potentially see another re-raise for 20 on top of that for 30 more. Absolutely. I felt okay about calling the $5 bet, but it seemed a really bad idea to call for anything more, especially up to $30.
Yeah.
Totally agree, Rick.
Yeah, good totally job. Agree.
So I muck. The button shoves, and the big blind calls.
Wow.
You know, I would not have expected this this to happen.
No way.
I'm pretty sure somebody had a flush, but I would not expect to get this crazy. So, all right, so the button turns up. Ace of hearts, ace of spades, four of spades, deuce of spades.
Did he think he made a wheel with three cards in his hand?
As he turned up his hand, his expression went blank all at once as it occurred to him just then that he couldn't play the four hearts on the board and all he had was the aces.
Well, he thought he had, what, a wheel? Or a short
flush? He had the flush.
Oh, a flush, yeah. Flush, yeah. Oh, man. That's why when I play with my family and we play Omaha, the first hand, I call everything down to the river because they always forget they can't play, they have to play two cards.
Well, again, yeah, and this is how, in a home game, all gloves are off in the normal poker rules because you got people that don't know what's going on. And now remember, at the beginning of the hand, which we kind of forgot, he said the dealer is the one that called the game.
Yeah.
And hadn't really played it very much, but likes it. So, I mean, this is always the number one thing when we do the Omaha classes. Two in your hand, three on the board.
Yeah.
And I have been repeated six times and then make people repeat it to me to the point that they want to throw me off the side of the ship. But it's so important because you make mistakes like this.
Yep.
Now, the big blind shows king, queen, 8-5.
For two pair?
Top pair to draw the turn, river king's up. That's it with three question marks, Rick says. All that action, all he had was two pair, three more question marks. I was dumbfounded. I folded top set for that, three more question marks.
Oh, man. But you have to. You have to fold, right?
Yeah, I mean, again, I mean, you made a good fold, even if it was the wrong decision, and it goes back to the beginning where he said, you know, I'm going to try to be result-oriented. You can't be. I mean, you're trying to learn this game because there's going to be a time when you're playing Omaha in a real casino against real people that know what they're doing and not, pardon my pun, jackasses on the jackasses to a poker tour, you know? And in that moment, if you're a good enough player to separate the fact that you're playing with people like that and you're going to make some weird moves that's not going to poison your Omaha game, that's terrific. But if you're trying to learn and trying to reinforce good play, you're going to have to make some of these what now seems to be gut-wrenching laydowns.
To paraphrase Lee Childs, you always want to make good decisions. And you want to make the easiest decisions that you can. You want to be set up to make the easiest decisions that you can. Your call of $5 was the right move because the first player really didn't know what they were doing and overvalued their hand. So that was okay. In the real world, in a game where everyone knows Omaha and everyone plays for serious money or good money or even just plays enough, when you get raised behind like that and then 3-bet again, you know that you are behind 99% of the time. So you've made the right decision. Whether you fold the wrong hand or the best hand or not, every once in a while you have to fold the best hand.
He says, after some wailing and gnashing of teeth, gnashing is such a good verb. I'm going to start using that. After some wailing and gnashing of teeth, I came to understand that the big blind grotesquely overvalued. Oh my God, this guy. He needs to start writing poetry. I would read it. Gnashing and grotesquely in the same sentence. The big blind grotesquely.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. Overvalued is two pair due to lack of experience with Omaha. Both guys are pretty green to it, so these mistakes are understandable. It is just frustrating to see those cards after I fold it. However, in the end, I really think I couldn't call there, and I'm trying not to be results-oriented. All caps, screaming Chris, tell me I made the correct laydown.
Yeah, he did. He made the right move. I don't know if you could have played the hand any differently other than the big bet after the flop. We should have made a bigger bet, I think. You bet $10. I really don't think that ace is sticking around. And even if it is, you got the best hand. And I don't know if king rag is going to stick around. And if he does, you know, you can shut it down on the turn. But really, the bigger bet on the flop might have gotten one of them out. And That's how you can play.
He might have got re-raised by the aces there, and then you want that then, because he's essentially he's drawing the two outs to beat you at that point.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the situation you want when you have kings, is to flop a set and have somebody else with aces, you know?
Yeah. So the moral of the story is do not grotesquely overplay your hand in Omaha.
Rick. All right, we recently sent you some swag, so no more coming your way right now. But everybody else, send your hands of the week to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. The cover's getting a little bare, too, lately. So you know, I've been saving up some of those marginal ones. Send it to us. Let us decide whether they're marginal or not.
Yeah.
It's not grotesquely marginal. We'll get it on the show. If we do, we may send you something great, like a deck of J-Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Anti-Up. You pick up your own decks in the Anti-Up store at antiupstore.com.
Another good show. I'm Chris Cosenza.
I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.
It's always a great day here at Annie Up headquarters when I get to subject you, Chris, to an Omaha hand of the week.
No, we gotta talk about your trip to New Mexico.
No, we already did that last week.
Oh, we did it. Okay, but did we do an intro for it, though? I can't remember.
Yeah, we did the whole thing, yeah.
We did an intro. Okay. Okay, I couldn't remember if we did an intro. I was reading this thing and thought we had to do an intro. Okay.
I was just putting on there to remind you to put it in the show. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, no, I know. I wasn't sure if we did an intro.
Come over and hold your freaking hand today. Call Jeannie, tell her to go home. You know, cook you lunch so you don't burn yourself.
We haven't had outtakes in a long time on the show, so this is a good one to put in there. All right, go ahead.
Oh, man.
Why? When I saw that thing in New Mexico, I thought we had to do an intro for it. I forgot. Okay. Go ahead. Just start
I'm
over.
I'm trying. I got to get a laugh in here.
Just start over.
Oh, my gosh.